It's close to 7 o'clock, so I think we'll get started. I want to thank everybody for coming. My name is Steve Shadley, and I'm the program director of Northern Public Radio, WNIJ, and we are here to learn something new today. We are talking about medical cannabis, and this is a part of our Context Public Affairs series. We are proud to present these occasional get-togethers like we're having tonight, where we're talking about issues that matter to all of us. So again, thank you. I know some of you came long distances to be here, so we really appreciate it. Just a couple things before we get started on the cannabis issue. We're having a contest here at WNIJ. We are asking, do we have any artists in the audience? Okay, good. You're a good candidate for a contest. We're designing a calendar for 2016, and we want to have people submit their artwork, and it can be photography, it could be sculpture, it could be drawings or oil paintings or experimental art, whatever you're into, but there are flyers in the back of the auditorium where you can learn more details. The deadline is coming up, though. It's the end of July, so it's a great way to get your work published if you're interested. The WNIJ calendar. Okay, before we get started, I just want to talk a little bit about why we're doing this tonight. I have a personal story. I don't want to lecture, but my father recently got his medical cannabis card, and he lives in Arizona. And if you knew my dad, you would think this is the last person on earth that would try medical marijuana. And when I was growing up, I grew up in Phoenix, and my dad was a rancher. He's retired now, but he's been suffering from diabetes, and he also is getting the onset of Parkinson's, so he has the hand tremors and sort of the head nods. And so we've always urged him, please go see a doctor. And he's the kind of rough and tumble guy that, you know, always says, no, I don't want to see a doctor. So finally he went and saw a doctor, and they said, yeah, you might have Parkinson's disease. So if you knew my dad, he's one of these guys who's sort of a flag-waving, proud American rancher guy, a man's man who would never, ever smoke pot. So now he's got a card. And I talked to him on Father's Day, and he goes, how do you roll a joint? And I said, why are you asking me? So now he actually has the neighbor lady roll his joints, and he's experimenting with it. He's not sure if he likes it. So I'm still undecided on the issue personally, but I have to say that having a father who's actually using medical cannabis now, I think that means something. So I think a lot of people here have stories about their personal issues, and we're gonna take some audience questions toward the end of the seminar tonight. Let's introduce our panel members, and I'll just start here, and if you could introduce yourself, please, and tell us why you're here. We'll start with over there.
Thanks, everyone. Thank you, Stephen, for having us today. We really appreciate the time and certainly the community coming out today to hear us talk. My name is John Legia. I am the Chief Operations Officer for PharmaCann. PharmaCann is a licensee holder for pursuant to the Illinois Compassionate Use of Cannabis Act in the state of Illinois. PharmaCann has two cultivation facilities that are currently under construction. One is in Hillcrest, and the second is in the town of Dwight. And PharmaCann operates under the name PharmaCannis with respect to its dispensary operations. We have four dispensaries. One in Evanston, one in North Aurora, Schaumburg, and then the town of Ottawa. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, everybody. Thank you. I'm Christina Legia. I'm also with PharmaCann and PharmaCannis. My role there is I'm the Chief Marketing and Sales Officer for the company. One of the things that I'm involved with is education to patients and physicians and making them aware of the program through the Illinois Department of Health, and working with the communities that, as John had mentioned, where we have dispensaries and cultivations in. So I really thank you for inviting us here today. I'm excited to hear from the group. So thank you.
Thank you for being here.
Hello, my name is Brad Valerius. I work for Revolution Enterprises. We are also a cultivation center licensee. We have built two facilities. One is near the city of Quincy. The other is near the city of Peoria. They're both 75,000 square feet in area. I'm an attorney. My title is director of communications, because one of the more important things that I do is communicate with journalists and the media to make sure that the messages are clear and accurate. I'm not an owner of the company, I'm only an employee, and I am probably one of the very first people hired under this new law. I joined the company in February after they're identified as one of the licensees, and I'm very proud of that. I was able to earn the spot because I first read this new law a few days after it was passed by the governor, and I saw how much, I'm sorry, after it was signed by the governor, and I saw how much economic opportunity there was for the state. The thing that really attracted me to it was the fact that the cultivation centers and dispensaries had to be distributed somewhat fairly throughout the state, so that every region, every district of the Illinois State Police has a cultivation center. So I started my journey closer to St. Louis, and if you grow up downstate, you're used to seeing the Chicago regions get most of the economic benefits, but this new law told me that I could find a career if I worked hard at it, and that's why I'm proud to be here today.
Thank you for coming.
Well, I'll echo the rest of the panel, and thank you for having me, and thank you for having us and discussing this important topic. My name is Dan Lynn. I've been a volunteer with the Illinois chapter of Normal for over a decade, medical cannabis activist extraordinaire. I was a personal assistant for a quadriplegic friend of mine for about 4 years. At one time, I was arrested for cannabis. That was his medicine. I'm currently a part-time staff member with the Illinois Cannabis Industry Association, and have been a lobbyist for about 7 years now, working specifically on medical cannabis and drug policy reform.
Very good. So I am not an expert on this issue, so I'm just like you. I think we're all curious about what's going on in Illinois with medical cannabis, and so I'm going to hopefully ask questions that you would like to ask, but we do have these cards on the chairs. And so if you have a specific question that I'm not asking, or if you can ask it better than me, then please feel free to write down your question. If you want to use your name, you can. If you want to remain anonymous, then certainly you can do that. And I will read the questions aloud to our panelists this evening. So I'm going to start with a question I have. So this law is just a couple years old now. And right in the law itself, it said compassionate medical cannabis pilot project, right? Pilot program. Okay, so we're a few years now into the program, and still we are not getting access to our medicine. So is this really compassionate? I'm just going to throw that out. Why is it taking so long for people to get their pharmaceuticals pertaining to medical cannabis? Anybody can start.
You know, I think the state of Illinois has decided that it wanted to move forward in a very prudent manner. And so I think you see that very high level professionalism coming out of the state and setting up and administering the program. I understand that it can seem like the issue that is it compassionate to take 4 years to get medicine. But I think, from my understanding, it was when the bill was originally being discussed, it was going to be for a 3-year period of time. Mm-hmm. But there was an understanding that it would take a significant investment of capital and time to get these facilities to get there. To have the applications be generated, properly reviewed to make sure that the qualified applicants receive the licenses, and then building out those facilities. And so that was all included in the additional year for the extension of the program. So I think I certainly understand that there are patients in need, but when you look at how the state has administered the program, the quality of the applicants and the selection process, I think that they've done the right thing by acting in a prudent manner to make sure that the program can be successful for the long term. And that's an important point here, that it's a pilot program. For it to really be successful, the program has to do well in this period and then be extended indefinitely. And I think that's everyone's goal here on this panel today.
Well, let me just interject, if you don't mind. So right now, there is currently a bill on Governor Bruce Rauner's desk that was sponsored by Lou Lang, State Representative Lou Lang, a Democrat from Skokie, and the bill was passed in both chambers. We know the budget's a mess and everything right now, so obviously that seems to be a priority, legislatively speaking, but the governor now has that bill that would basically extend the pilot program for another 4 years after the first dispensary opens. So The governor, I read in the paper today, at least his spokespeople are saying that he's not for the bill, but we'll see what happens. Time is of the essence here, though, because you know the time is ticking when we get these bills on the governor's desk. So this budget thing might be in the way. We're not sure. Obviously, the budget is the problem right now. So with the pilot project, the way it stands now, we know there have been some changes made to the original legislation. How, and any of you can answer this, please feel free, Bradley, maybe this is your area of expertise, but how has the law changed in the last few years, and how does that affect patients?
Actually, I think it's probably more appropriate for Dan. The okay. only way in which I'm aware of it having changed is language allowing adding seizures and epilepsy and minor use. Were there any others?
There's a little bit of cleanup language dealing with insurance companies not having to cover the cost of this medicine. And just to kind of back up a second, the whole reason that it's a pilot program and not just a permanent law is because over the course of 10 years of trying to get this legislation through, you make certain compromises and you play certain political games. And one of the favorites that the state of Illinois likes to do is to make things have what's known as a sunset clause so that you have these trial periods for these new ideas. But I don't think anybody realistically thinks that once when you get this medicine in the hands of the people that truly need it, that the state of Illinois is just going to let that expire and take away that medicine. I can tell you the specific meeting when we put the pilot program into the legislation back in 2008 and got the bill through 2009 in the Senate. But I think that the idea of it being a temporary program was just something put in there to get the votes to get this law passed. And I don't expect that this medicine will ever be taken away from the patients in Illinois once when they get access to it.
Can we back up the minor issues? So what was the law before they made the change? We're talking about people's ages here, obviously. So.
Sure. So the law that allows for the compassionate use of medical cannabis in Illinois, House Bill 1, that was passed in 2013, took effect January 1st, 2014. It didn't allow minors to be involved in this program, minors being defined as anybody under 18. That was something that was highly contentious. It was something that was added into the legislation I believe it was 2 or 3 years before the bill actually got put in. But it was also something that we could sit here and talk about, you know, denying 12-year-old kids with cancer access to a medicine that they can have if they make it to 19 or 18. That's not something that's fair. That's not something that I think people in Illinois and the general public wants to see happen, but the highly contentious nature of politics makes it so that if somebody doesn't want to support medical cannabis and their law does allow for minors to be involved in it, you could say, well, this 17-year-old kid that has Crohn's disease could be buying all sorts of pot and selling it to his high school colleagues. And that's why the original law didn't have minors included. The real big game changer was that Dr. Sanjay Gupta did a special on CNN showcasing how much epileptic kids were benefiting from the use of medical cannabis, specifically a high CBD oil. And then we were able to mobilize a significant number of parents and families that had epileptic children in Illinois to make it a law that allowed for minors, not just with epilepsy, but minors that have any of the qualifying condition, participate in the program.
CBD is cannabinoids?
CBD is a specific cannabinoid. There are about 75 different cannabinoids that make up the cannabis compound, and it's each of these individual compounds in the cannabis plant that are starting to be investigated and researched. CBD is one of the more high-profile ones now, but for a long time, THC was really the only cannabinoid that people were talking about. THC is the one that gives people that euphoric or high effect. CBD does not have that same type of effect, and in a lot of ways, it's been the holy grail of medical cannabis because the lawmakers, and you see this in like the law in Georgia, they don't want to be allowing people to get high, but if you can give them the medical benefits without that euphoric effect, that's a little bit more politically tolerable than allowing people to have access to the full plant material that includes THC.
Okay,
and that's unfortunate.
Okay, thank you. So minors are not allowed to smoke it. It's only edibles or through
tinctures, salves, lotions, pills.
Okay, very good.
And a point that may be worth adding, it's not technically a change in the law, but but it is important for our industry here in Illinois that there's a review board pursuant to the Act, which meets. Applications are submitted for adding additional debilitating medical conditions. That review board met and received applications to add 14 new medical debilitating conditions, and of those 14, 11 were passed and now go for further review and approval. But the conditions that have been added include PTSD as well as osteoarthritis and several and nine other conditions. So we're certainly excited to see that the conditions and the patients that are suffering from those conditions can then elect to use medical cannabis for relief. Some of the diseases that were not granted approval, I think one was anxiety, for example,
right.
That they're looking for a little additional data and information to show a causal link between relief from those conditions and use of medical cannabis. But we're certainly hopeful that in the future that can be added.
Okay, so for people who've already qualified and have their cards in hand, when will they be able to make their purchases at this point?
From PharmaCann, that's a kind of a question for the industry as a whole. I think everybody, the cultivation centers, I think are working as fast as they can to build their facility and then start cultivating crops. I think just generally speaking, it seems like the entities that are moving the fastest appear ready or soon to be ready to start actually cultivating. I'm not so sure the quantities that'll be available immediately, but my guess is from our company, PharmaCann, you're looking at product delivery in the fall. And there's another component. One is getting cultivation centers that are cultivating, growing, and there's 3-4 month lead time on from the moment you start growing the crop until it's harvested and ready for sale. But the other component is dispensary owners and how fast and able are they able to get their shops up and running. PharmaCann, as mentioned, with our 4 dispensaries, we're on track as well to have those up and running by early fall.
So what's the big holdup now? Is it because of all of the regulations? We know there are a number of different state agencies. There's a board of people from the community. And is it just a mishmash of that bureaucracy that's really holding up this whole project, the program right now?
There's not necessarily a holdup right now. Licenses were awarded, and then all of these organizations, the cultivation centers which were awarded the licenses, are given 6 months in which to begin production. That 6 months is necessary to build a facility or else retrofit an already existing one. So that's what's taking place right now. If most began in February, if you start the clock, I don't remember if it was February or March. Those that are ready to begin right now are well within the required framework, and they will begin momentarily, assuming there's nothing on the state's end to slow things down. And that puts product in the market around fall, October, November, 3.5 to 4 months from now.
So the way the state law is written now, all of the medical cannabis that is consumed in Illinois must be grown in Illinois. It can't come from outside other states.
No, that's correct. And I would add that I think there is a complicated framework here, but I think it would be wrong to characterize that there's some sort of holdup. You have to remember that there are 3 state agencies that work with medicinal plants and medical cannabis. One is the Department of Agriculture. They're overseeing, obviously, the cultivation operations. Then you have the Illinois Department of Health, which is involved in dispensaries, as well as the Illinois Department of Financial and Professional Regulations. I think there was some concern early on with 3 state agencies. How would that work? What would be the communication? But from our standpoint, from PharmaCann's view and standpoint, there haven't been holdups. We certainly see them working as hard as they can to, do each step and make sure things are done correctly as they're moving along, and we're certainly quite pleased with that.
And I just want to add the Illinois Department of Health, months ago we were seeing that patients were applying and it was taking, up to 2 months to actually receive the cards. Now we're seeing them actually get turnaround on cards in 2 weeks. So they are really getting their program underway and things are moving along. And so patients are able to get their cards much quicker than they were several months ago. So the process is moving in the right direction.
Okay, so it sounds like we're making some progress. So if I'm a patient and I feel like I have one of these debilitating diseases, what's the first step? How do I get a card? How do I find a doctor who will understand where I am? And can somebody walk us through the process?
I can take you through part of it, I think. The initial step for a patient who wants to potentially register for a card is to make your doctor visit and first go and have that meeting with your doctor and discuss your debilitating conditions, understand about medical marijuana, have a good understanding of the program, and discuss it with that physician to see if it's appropriate, if it's appropriate for you, if it's something that you can qualify for. Once you've established that that with your physician and your physician has determined that you would qualify and may receive therapeutic or palliative benefit from medicinal marijuana, then the physician fills out a certification. And the physician takes that certification and does not give it back to the patient, but sends that certification in separately to the Illinois Department of Health. So that's really the initial first step, is that meeting with your physician, having the physician certify that the patient does have a debilitating condition, that the patient has a bona fide relationship with that physician and has ongoing care treatment with that physician and may receive palliative or therapeutic benefit from medicinal marijuana. Once that has been done, then the patient's responsibility is to fill out a form also from the Illinois Department of Health. They fill the form out. It's about 3 or 4 pages long, asking very general questions and information. They take that form and have to send that in to the Illinois Department of Health with 2 proofs of residency, so an electric bill or a phone bill, 2 copies of proof of residency, along with a driver's license or state ID card that must be copied and colored and sent in. And then the final 2 steps are to go get a fingerprint and a background check done and have that form filled out and attached with your application along with a passport photo. So what do you need? You need the application, you need 2 proof of residency, you need a copy of a state ID, and you need your fingerprint background check form along with the passport photo. You take all of those things, you put it in an envelope, you send it off to the Illinois Department of Health. The Illinois Department of Health then takes your forms and your information, finds your doctor's certification, and matches it up. And if you qualify under the Illinois Department of Health's program, you receive a letter initially from them saying that you've qualified for the program, and once dispensaries are open, you'll choose your dispensary and receive the card.
Wow, easy peasy, right? It feels really easy.
I know it's easier than.
Yeah, I know. It's a very controlled program, and I suppose it should be. So if you are denied a medical marijuana card in Illinois, can you appeal, or is it as simple as going out and finding another doctor who's more compassionate with your needs?
You know, if the Illinois Department of Health says that you do not qualify for the program, they will give you a reason. It's my understanding of why you are not qualifying for the program. You can certainly take that up with your doctor. There's a number of different reasons why you may not qualify. But it's really up to the Illinois Department of Health to determine whether you're going to receive that card. It's not up to your physician. The physician simply fills out the certification and sends it into the state.
We're not experts on the administrative review process, but I would assume that, like all administrative agency decisions, that there's an appeal process with that agency as well as then to the district court if one should so elect to do that.
Okay, and how long is the card valid? Is this something you must renew every year?
Yes. So the card is good for 1 year, and then you have to be recertified at the end of a year. So what does that mean? That means that you have to do all of that again. You have to do the certification through the physician, and you have to fill out all the forms and do the fingerprint and the passport photo and all of that again. So it's a 1 year. The recommendation is to schedule your doctor's visits 90 days out from when that 1 year expires to make sure that the card is renewed in time.
Okay. Go ahead, Brett.
There's something worth highlighting among all of that, and that's the fingerprint background check. The reason they're doing that is because anyone who's been convicted of what the law calls an excluded offense is prohibited from participating in the pilot program. I can't answer why. I didn't pass the law. I don't necessarily think it's a constitutional provision, but that's what it is. An excluded offense is a violent crime, which pretty much means a felony violent crime, are a controlled substances felony, which includes cannabis. However, if the underlying action for which your cannabis conviction is based was for a medical use, you can apply for a waiver, and they may grant it to you.
Well, Dan, this sounds very, very complicated, and I've heard through the grapevine that Illinois has one of the most restrictive controlling medical cannabis laws in the country. How does it compare with the 24 or so other states that have passed this program?
Yeah, I think it definitely is one of the most restrictive. I think it is overly burdensome on the patients. I think a lot of the problems and restrictions were put in place simply as part of the political process. I think the pilot program is something that's unique to Illinois. I don't think any other state has decided to do a test project for medicine like this. And, you know, I think when, you know, we're talking about the excluded offenses or denying access to medicine for somebody for a past conviction, I do think that is something, as Brad mentioned, that could be challenged in court. My conversations with the Illinois ACLU is that they don't want to take up this issue. And I've heard from patients, I haven't been able to verify this, though, that patients that were denied access into the program for one of those excluded offenses did get letters of reconsideration for the program. I haven't been able to get a copy of one of those letters of reconsideration, but it is something that I've heard from at least two patients in Illinois.
Okay, I'm just curious, from your point of view, what's the most frustrating thing, if anything, that's happening in Illinois with medical cannabis at this point?
Frustrating would be patients having to get fingerprinted to get access to medicine that is comparatively safe considering the amount of overdose deaths from other pharmaceuticals. I think the medical community as a whole is extremely reluctant to embrace this natural medicine, and I think those two hurdles are why we see such a low patient count in Illinois, and I think that this program is not going to be as big of a return on investment for the people that did get into it and go after some of the business licenses.
I would add it's disappointing to see that this program isn't considered as a potential revenue maker for this crippled government that we're running.
Okay. Take that as a political statement. Thank you. That's okay. We allow that in public radio. So in Illinois, the way I understand the law as it stands now is that a single patient can possess 2.5 ounces over every 2 weeks, they can purchase 2.5 ounces. That sounds like an awful lot of weed. I mean, I went to college with guys that tried to smoke that much, but that seems like a lot of medicine there. Honestly, does that seem overblown to you guys?
I find your reaction interesting because it was the reaction I had when I first got involved in this business and heard that amount. So I've heard that seems like a lot, but then you start talking to patients in visits to Colorado, talking to dispensary owners, and I think if you realize that you're in hospice suffering from severe form of cancer, you're in dire pain, and maybe you've been on medical cannabis and you're now tolerant, our friends in Colorado tell us that amount for you is maybe way too low. It's half of what you need. And so I think it's dependent upon the person and to determine the amount of medicine they need for the relief that they deserve. And so making these snap judgments and saying, well, that just sounds like a lot, maybe you want to smoke too much, that's reminiscent of the high school or college kind of drug culture and not really focusing on patients that are sick with very serious conditions. And I think you have to understand that. This list of debilitating medical conditions in Illinois, if you have one of them, you are a very, very sick person. If you have one of those diseases, it's not something that you want, so you can then go buy some, quote, weed. You're a sick person, and you deserve access to medicine.
Okay, so are the edibles more potent generally than vaporizing medical cannabis, or are they pretty similar? If you eat something like a cookie or a brownie?
The difference is has to do, the form of administration really is, it's an important thing to learn about and make sure that you understand. I know there's a negative connotation to smoking. Smoking and vape is not smoking, it's actually just heating up below the point of combustion. But the effect is similar. If you were to smoke or vape through a vapor, it goes into your lungs and it's titrated very quickly. So that means you take it, you inhale, you know the effect. 10, 15 minutes later, you realize you had enough, and then you stop. effect goes away 30, 40 minutes, an hour later, as you start to diminish. Eating, it's a very different effect, and I think you have to know the difference. When you take it, when you eat it orally, it has to be digested and go through the bloodstream. That effect can be delayed 2-3 hours, and then the effect can come on and last for a longer period of time. And so, or sublingual is another method. That's tinctures that you hear. That's traditionally taken under the tongue. That absorbs very quickly into the bloodstream as well. Not quite as fast as smoking, but still relatively quickly. And so you see, there's others, oral mucosal spray, enteric tubes. You hear about the different forms, and it's important for patients to be educated on the form and method that works best for them. And I think to start, vaping is a nice option because people can dose and then moderate their effect to achieve what they desire.
Go ahead.
And I'd just like to comment that doctors can write a waiver so that you can have more than that 2.5 ounces per 2 weeks. And some of the patients that maybe have dietary restrictions will want to be producing their own edibles using, you know, the upper limits of the amount of flowers, cannabis that they can buy. And one of the other administrative methods that I'm not sure is even going to be able to exist in Illinois is the juicing of the raw leaves of cannabis that's starting to become a little more popular in Southern California, where they take the raw leaves of the plant and juice it just like you would juice a wheatgrass shot at the health club or the natural grocery store. And usually those wheatgrass shots are 1 ounce shots. And some patients are doing 3 of those shots per day in California. And in Illinois, I'm not sure that those products would even be available at the dispensaries, the raw leaves, let alone the juiced cannabis.
Or the butters or the other things that we've seen in other states.
Well, I think the butters and edibles will be available in Illinois. I just don't think that the raw juicing or the raw leaves for juicing will be available.
Okay. So right now, I know there's been a lot of, let's say, controversy, I think that's a safe word to say, about the research on medical marijuana, and it depends on who you ask on what day. There was, in fact, just a story on Morning Edition just a few days ago about a study that said basically, I think this was out of Great Britain, that said basically that, according to this test anyhow, this research project that was years long, that they concluded that medical cannabis was really only effective in treating small aches and pains, and they kind of threw out all of the other debilitating diseases. So how are we ever going to find out what's really effective with all these different studies going on? Do you have any opinions on that?
Yeah, I have a strong opinion on that. I think it was a quote from the Time magazine article from a month or so ago, and it was that the United States is a negative exporter of research when it comes to medical cannabis. We certainly, because it's a Schedule I on the federal level, it has really severely hindered the amount of research that can go into cannabis use at all levels, whether it's clinical trials, development of new drug products, access to patients, and of cause and effect. It's a serious problem. And so I was struck by it in two instances. One where I read an article about some university, I believe, of Wisconsin researchers. They had to go to China in order to find patients that were using cannabis in order to do their study. And so I think when you see that, you realize that you have this drug, even on an illicit level, is consumed by millions of Americans, and that through making it a Schedule I substance, and limiting valid researchers who want to conduct studies and research on and trials on the medicine, that they're prohibiting that. I think that's an issue. But you are seeing now that you see in the states, Colorado, there's a significant amount of funding now that's going to research into that state. And I think progress is being made. Certainly in Illinois, all the cultivation applicants had to include a research plan in order to identify exactly what type of research they would be doing at their facility. That was a component of our plan. I'm assuming it was definitely a component of ACES as well. And so I think we'll see, you know, in the coming months and years, a lot more scientific research and evidence coming out.
There was just, I come from Arizona, and at the University of Arizona in Tucson, there was actually a researcher that was fired for launching research into PTSD, the effects of medical cannabis on veterans returning from combat who were suffering PTSD symptoms.
Dr. Sisley.
Yeah, Sue Sisley, yes. And so she, last I heard, she was looking for another research project at another university, but a lot of people say that was a political decision. Arizona can be kind of conservative sometimes, and the Board of Regents said, we're going to nix that in the bud, even though it was outside funding from a private nonprofit group out of California. But there still is that stigma when it comes to funding research on medical cannabis. How do we get around that?
Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, and just to kind of get back to that Great Britain study, I mean, anytime anyone's doing research, you got to see who's funding it. They all have an agenda, one way or the other. National Institute on Drug Abuse, they're going to only fund or allow studies that are looking for the abuse of cannabis. I think if you look at the international community, there's a lot of research being done in Israel. There's a lot of research being done in Italy. There's a lot of research being done in Spain. And someday the folks in the U.S., especially the federal government, will realize that this is an industry that they're going to have to embrace or we're going to be playing catch-up.
Well, really, GW Pharmaceuticals is based out of the U.K. They have a drug named Sativex, which is a capsulized blend of CBD THC extracts, greenhouse-grown extract. And they that's licensed, I believe, 22, 23 countries. They have another product that's in phase two trials here in the U.S. as a pharmaceutical-grade product. I think any argument that says that there's no medicinal or pharmaceutical benefit or effect of cannabis, there's no merit to that argument. And the drug companies, the Sativex market cap of over $1 billion, I believe, at last look, there's a large market, there's a large potential for research. You know, when you look at the four known effects, antiemetic, analgesic, anti-inflammatory, there's also appetite stimulation. Those four known effects are widely recognized as a benefit of cannabis. There's just simply no doubt. Now, if you want to make an argument that when it comes to glaucoma, that you know, the amounts you have to take in order to relieve that, you know, intercocal eye pressure is too much. Okay, but really, it's hard to argue that. You know, you see this argument recently in a study by those two Yale researchers, and the headline is different from the actual text of the research, which is that we need to have more studying, more funding of research when it comes to medical cannabis to make sure we understand the effect. And the headline is you know, that there's no proven effect. But what they're saying is the drug policy in the U.S. and in Schedule I funding has caused a lack of valid medical research in this area promising research, and that certainly shouldn't be a reason to avoid patients' access to medicine. We talk about children with epilepsy. There are many, many people that have received benefit, and I think in some sense the proof has been in the pudding.
Well, really, I kind of think it does just come down to what makes you feel better as a patient, really as an individual, and so that's a very interesting aspect of this whole industry. Is it really an industry? Is it safe to say that? We hear that thrown around a lot. The whole marijuana industry. So firms like PharmaCannabis, we know there are 60 dispensaries that can be opened in Illinois according to the police district. Is that correct?
No, it's a little different. There were 22 cultivation licenses, which turned out to be 21 because one of those licenses was in the tollway district, which technically, you couldn't find a land within the zoning requirements. And those were allocated one per Illinois State Police District. So as Brad mentioned, that's spreading the called development dollars throughout the state. So, you know, we're in Ogle County and then Livingston. And the cultivators are spread throughout. Now, when it comes to the 60, I think the legislatures looked and came up with a geographic distribution, trying to have, you know, on average a certain number of patients or population per geographic area, and then it seems like that they allocated dispensaries on that basis. So the 60 dispensaries, clearly there's a lot of them smattering Chicago, but they're also around Rockford, you know, all the big cities, St. Louis, you know, as you would expect.
Okay, yeah, because it's a big state geographically, as we all know. How is the market going to work on this? I mean, are there going to be price wars, or how is that going to work? If I'm a medical marijuana patient and I want to find the best bang for my buck, I mean, are there going to be cheaper prices than some? If you go to other states, you see coupons in the newspaper. There are even commercials in California on TV. We have the cheapest stuff around. I don't know how it's going to work here. I'm not an expert. What do you think?
You know, the pricing of the product is an interesting, it's a good question. It's an interesting question because we're not quite there yet. There's no product, so determining exactly what the price is going to be. We as an industry, I think, have to come together and figure out what's appropriate. Certainly, there's many things to take into consideration when you're looking at pricing. You certainly can't have it too low because there's a diversion issue, and you can't have it too high because, unfortunately, it's not covered by insurance, and it's all out of pocket for patients. So it has to be appropriately enough so the average patient would be able to afford it. So with those two guidelines put in place, I think that everybody's going to fall in somewhere the same bucket in terms of the pricing.
There's something I'd like to add about what goes into the pricing, and it kind of touches on what we mentioned earlier about research and development and all the different cannabinoids. If we assume that the different cannabinoids and the different cannabinoid profiles have different effects on different people, on different debilitating medical conditions, then we're getting closer to a point where we can make better medicines that are more finely tailored for particular types of conditions. And Illinois law foresees that. Illinois law wants us to get as close as possible to the pharmaceutical industry when it comes to producing products that are consistent and pure, pure meaning free of contaminants. So everything that we produce is tested by an independent laboratory to verify that it is indeed pure, and that they will also test it for that cannabinoid profile. And that profile will go on the label of everything that's produced at a cultivation center and then distributed to a dispensary. What that means is a patient can feel confident going to a dispensary and choosing a product that truly is tailored for their particular condition. Whereas if you're buying something off the black market, you don't really know what you're getting. You're taking the word of someone you've purchased it from who may have purchased it from some other source, and they're taking the credibility of that person. You really have no idea.
Okay, so my next question is, right now there's a little bit of, I don't want to say panic, but certainly concern statewide about there simply aren't enough patients here to sustain the dispensaries that we plan on opening at some point. We have a few thousand patients, if I understand correctly, about 2,000 or more around there. And I know people are thinking, well, once the dispensaries open, more people will try to qualify for cards. But that's got to be a concern for people opening these businesses at this time.
Well, you know, I can speak to that a little bit. So right now, the number is 2,500 patients. So, yeah,
Not a lot. No,
it's very low. I think there's a lot of different things playing into, I guess, what we refer to as patient barriers in terms of why are not patients signing up, going through the process, getting the card so that once dispensaries open, they're able to receive access. There's a lot of things playing into that. Certainly, I think in speaking with patients, part of it is, well, once product's available, then I'll pay my $100 to the state and get my card. But why pay that now when product's not available? So we're certainly hearing that. But I think there's a piece to it of which I'm very much involved with in education in terms of the process and what has to happen and what the program is and what the state's saying. And those pieces have to be communicative very much to physicians. I think physicians have a lack of understanding to the program and what their responsibility is, and that it's not a prescription. It's actually just a certification. Number of physicians that I speak with, I still... every physician will say, well, it's a prescription, and how do I write the prescription? It's not a prescription. It's a certification. So there's just a fundamental misunderstanding, I think, with the physicians and and getting them educated in terms of how the program works. And once that piece, once we've been able to have physicians understand the process and the program, the discussion between the patient and the physician will occur. And that's the important piece, in my opinion, is that the physician has that conversation with the patient to determine whether it's appropriate, to determine whether they have a condition that they may receive some benefit from. But until that conversation happens, we're still going to see the lag kind of in the numbers, I think.
And I would just like to reemphasize that point, because I think it's worth noting again that, and this means, a prescription means something specific to a doctor. And so when they are under the impression that, oh, this is a prescription, they, in my opinion, I think they're afraid of that. But it's not a prescription. It's a very important point. It's just a certification. And we've seen in our experience that once you make doctors aware of that, they say, oh, well, of course, then what's the problem? And I think that leads to a second point that, that Christina mentioned. Now everyone expects it to be patient-driven. They expect that if you're sick, you have to walk into your doctor's office and say, hey, this is something that I want or I need. But there is a component of making sure that doctors understand that they're part of the dialogue, saying to their patients either that are on home hospice care or that feel facing, you know, their debilitating medical condition, to say, hey, have you thought of this? I know your opioid medicines aren't working or they're causing you extreme adverse side effects. This is something you may want to consider and to try. And if we can get the conversation being driven from the doctor side, I think then that certainly can benefit the patient population in Illinois as well.
Dan, I know you had some opinions about getting doctors informed on this issue. What are your concerns at this point?
Well, right now, doctors are used to being approached and learning about drugs by the pharmaceutical sales reps that are looking to sell them those drugs. So the pharmaceutical sales reps take out the doctors to lunch, or they have these junkets and talk to them about the latest drug to treat whatever symptom. We don't see that yet coming from the medical cannabis industry. We don't see cannabis in the pharmacopoeia like all other drugs are. It was removed after they made cannabis illegal in 1937. And you also have some of these larger medical groups and hospitals that have top-down directives telling their doctors that they can't write these certifications or recommendations. And a lot of doctors are affiliated with hospitals and broader medical groups. The reasoning why, or the paper trail of those directives, we can only speculate upon, but a lot of it probably has to do with those hospitals having a controlled substance license that could in theory be jeopardized by having doctors write those recommendations or certify patients for this program.
Okay, go ahead, Brett.
Eventually though, they're all going to have a patient sooner or later who is admitted and has the right to use their medicine. So they need to evolve sooner or later, hospitals.
Okay, just want to remind you, if you have questions, please jot them down on the cards, and we'll take a break here in just a couple of moments, and then we'll get to your questions after we take a little intermission here. But I do want to just talk a little bit about patients' rights. So if I'm a patient and I have a certified card, how am I going to protect my privacy if I don't want this to be known by my employer, my landlord, my neighbors? Can somebody address that issue for me?
We can only speak to it from the dispensary side, but we have certain rules, protocols, and a privacy policy in place. All of the patient information is, it's questionable whether or not the information is HIPAA, but we certainly treat it as such. And so from the PharmaCann standpoint, we strive and work very hard to make sure that patient confidentiality is kept and maintained.
Okay.
The law does provide some protections to registered cardholders. Employers are prohibited from discriminating against applicants on the basis of their being registered as a cardholder. Landlords are prohibited from discriminating against a prospective tenant on the basis of their being a cardholder. However, they can prevent a patient from smoking in their property, but they can't prohibit a patient from using medicine in their property. And then a university or a college is prevented from discriminating against a prospective student on the grounds that the person is a registered cardholder.
And they couldn't smoke in the dorms. They would have to do the edibles if you were a student living on campus.
Right, if the university enacted such a policy.
What about if I'm a medical marijuana patient and I travel a lot for my job and I need to take my medicine with me? Am I allowed to transport this if it's in a properly identified container to another state?
No. No.
Never across state lines, and if within the state, then there's a whole separate set of rules that apply. The law has a set of rules for safe use and possession, and they're pretty intuitive. Mm-hmm. You know, you shouldn't ever do it in public, in public sight. That's and there's a whole other set of places where generally the law wants to push it out of public use, public sight. The employment context is actually a really important one, and the courts are probably going to have to settle that out because on the one hand, you can't discriminate against an employee, and then you may have an employee who's already on staff, and suddenly they develop a condition and they become a registered cardholder. And yet, if you're an employer, you may be concerned about a patient, about an employee now has the right to consume medical cannabis, and your worry is they'll come to the job, maybe a little bit having a psychoactive effect, and you don't want that to affect their doing the job. So it's not entirely clear yet how that resolves itself. The law allows employers to... it's been a long time since I've read this part of the law, but to form their own internal policies and procedures that prevent the use at work, I think. Have you read it recently?
Yeah, they can still maintain their drug-free workplace. So if your employer drug tests and you're a medical cannabis patient, they can still fire you for using medical cannabis, and those court cases, there have been rulings on that from other states.
Well, Colorado, we just saw, I think it was Colorado this
Colorado,
past week.
Michigan with Walmart had a case too.
Interesting. What if I'm on public assistance? If I'm a welfare recipient or I get other federal or public aid, am I allowed to qualify for a card? In Arizona, there was an attempt in the legislature there for drug testing welfare recipients, including medical cannabis. Would that happen in Illinois, or what are your concerns concerning that issue?
Well, I mean, there's always going to be some lawmaker that wants to introduce a bill like that. I don't think it's ever going to pass in Illinois. I don't think that the...
It got out of committee in Arizona and went to the full House, and then they ran out of time. But
yeah, I mean, I don't think that any of the social services that allow for people to have cash, so people that can withdraw cash from their link card, I think they would be able to use that money to purchase their medicine, yeah. I don't think there would be any restriction on people on social services not having medical cannabis, because the law specifically says that if you're already on disability, you get a lower fee for your application as a patient.
So what are law enforcement attitudes concerning medical cannabis? And this is a touchy issue, I'm sure, state to state, but here in Illinois specifically, are we working with the law enforcement community on this issue at this point, or what's going on?
Well, law enforcement is upset that they're not allowed to be patients. First,
interesting. Foremost. Yeah, that's interesting.
Wow. We're working on that, though, because we do know that some of the law enforcement officers, firefighters, and EMTs that are not allowed to be patients do suffer from PTSD. So we're hoping once when we can get PTSD included, that we can then remove that restriction for our first responders. But it's really a mixed bag. Some law enforcement officers in different parts of the state don't have an issue with this. Others think that this is a big abomination.
Is this just going to open the door for recreational marijuana sales in Illinois? Is this helping that cause? I mean, you're with Normal. What do you think, Dan?
I think it has definitely kicked the can down the road a little bit. I think that at some point we're going to see this opened up for all adults to use, just like we saw with alcohol prohibition, where people had medical alcohol cards during prohibition. We have medical cannabis cards during cannabis prohibition. I think more states are going to look at the revenue side of things with cannabis, and I see someday that the people in Illinois that are adults will be allowed to consume this product. I think some of the bigger questions are how much of a protectionism is there from the medical industry to only allow those licenses to be the industry side of things once when we go to full recreational. I think allowing adults to cultivate cannabis in their homes or backyards, I think, is another issue that we can keep an eye on. And I think that if we take a lesson from alcohol prohibition, when that ended, it was 40 years after the repeal of alcohol prohibition before we were legally allowed to home brew wine and beer.
Okay, with that, I think this is a good time to take a break for just a breather here for about 10 minutes. It's 5 to 8 now. We'll get back here, let's say 5 past 8 or so. And I want to talk about the dispensary experience. If I'm a customer walking into a dispensary, what will I expect? How does that work? And then let's get to your questions, because I think that's why you're all here. And we're all very curious to hear the responses from the panel. So let's just take 5. There's water and cookies. The restrooms are right down the hall here to your left. And thank you for coming again. So we'll be back here in 10 minutes. Okay, thanks. Okay. Maybe if we can start thinking about the second part of our contact symposium here. Thank you. Okay, if anybody has a card that they have not passed up, this is a good time to do it. So thank you very much. And I'll see if I can get to all of them here, or most of them anyhow. So before we get to the questions from our audience members, just want to kind of review what we've talked about already. We've talked about Illinois' law, what's going on with the getting a card. And I got a bunch of questions here about, more specifically, thank you, about cards. How much are the cards? We just want to clarify. I got a couple questions here about that.
How much are the...
For the medical cannabis card in Illinois?
It's $100 to the Illinois Department of Health.
$100?
$100. So you pay that every year. For the live scan and fingerprint check, those we're seeing coming in anywhere from $65 to $70 to those vendors. And then your passport photo to go get that done is anywhere from $10 to $15.
Okay, this is sort
of... There's also a discounted rate for people that are on disability, and I believe there was the legislation that also would have included veterans getting a $50 rate.
Okay, well, that's good. Maybe that helps some of us here. I'm not sure, hopefully, because money's not easy to come by. Another question that seems to be thematic among these questions is, people want to know, is this covered by Medicaid? Medical cannabis in Illinois. Again, I'm not an expert. So.
No, it is not.
Okay. Will it ever be? I guess it depends on who the next president is, right? Well, that's a question I have. So we have a new administration coming in soon in the White House. So how would that change everything? I mean, could a new president come in and say, look, we're just going to scrap it all. This is illegal. States can't do this any longer.
I think what you would see is you could have a new administration come in and a change of attitude. A new attorney general who decides that they want to prosecute medicinal cannabis providers. The question is, what's the likelihood of that happening?
Yeah.
We've seen studies, surveys that say that there's an acceptance rate of approaching or above 80% in this country with respect to medical cannabis. And so change of administration, Chris Christie aside, I think when you have 80% approval rating, that it's highly unlikely that you're going to see reversal from the next administration, whether it's Democrat or Republican, on this topic. But that'd be my own personal opinion.
Well, isn't the cat kind of out of the bag now? I mean, wouldn't it be hard for anybody, no matter what their political view, to come in and say, look, we're going to change everything because we can?
Well, I think the cat is out of the bag. I think with 80% approval rating, I think with images of epileptic children and mothers that are crusading for the medicine that their children deserve, I think that's a very hard message for any lawmaker to overcome. And I think, but if I wanted to be cynical, you would say that the tax dollars and tax revenue that are generated are really the final nail in the coffin, that once the states start receiving that money, that's not something that they want to turn down.
Another theme I'm seeing in the questions is, how do we find a list of doctors that can help us get a medical cannabis card? Is there a list online or anything, or is it just a shot in the dark?
A physician that's going to certify a patient for the program needs to have a bona fide relationship with that patient. So it needs to be a physician that patient is under their care. So there's really not a list available of physicians who would certify patients, because you need to have an established relationship with your physician.
Okay, and as cultivator producers, People want to know about the upfront investments required. And as investors, and I know this is somewhat of, you know, a living for some people out there, what goes into that? I mean, you're trying to launch a business that takes a lot of money, a lot of overhead, and then this pilot program, frankly, could be ended after a couple of years. I mean, that's kind of gutsy. Tell us more about that. Well, since you put it that way. Right?
I try not to think about it, otherwise I'll wake up in night sweats. I certainly think for any cultivator in this state that the applicants that were awarded their licenses, the investment that it requires to bring a cultivation center up and running, and I think almost all of them were new whitefield developments, meaning from the ground up buildings, and some of them are quite large. Our facilities are 40, 45,000 square feet. I believe Ace Revolution is at least 75,000 square feet. And so by times two, and so, you know, the investment in people, resources, and money to get this up under a strict regulatory scheme, security cameras, employees, it is an incredibly large, significant investment. But ultimately, this is a unique time within this country, a new time within the state of Illinois to get involved in something. It's not just in the ground floor, but from a social policy perspective, is helping patients, helping people in need get the medicine that they need. And so, you know, you're balancing that risk among the social cause and social justice aspect.
And just one other point I wanted to make for that, because it is very stressful. It's my husband and I, and you know, this is our full-time job now, and but you come to events like this here tonight, and I just spent, you know, the last 10 minutes talking to different patients in the room and hearing the stories. And it's moments like this that I get inspired, and I say, this is why we're doing this. This is really an important thing. This is an important moment in time when things are shifting, and we need to be a part of it. And so, yeah, it is stressful and it's a lot, but we never kind of lose sight of why we're doing this, and coming to events like this help keep us on point.
And we appreciate what you've done.
All right, so it's a vote of confidence. Awesome. You were going to say something, Brad, to add to that?
I was going to echo that exactly. At our company, and I'm sure at every licensee, it's become a moral obligation for us to get medicine out there as quickly as possible, and we all work tirelessly.
I have another question here, and this is anonymous, but it says, I am 65 years old and have suffered periodically my whole life from clinical depression and PTSD, and it says marijuana is the only thing that helps me, and can I request a certificate from my family doctor for depression symptoms at this point in Illinois?
Unfortunately, at this time, you cannot, and that's... You know, we certainly are aware of many people out there who suffer from depression, anxiety. For some reason, anxiety was just presented to the board, and it was deemed not to be added as another debilitating medical condition. But I know that there are industry associations. There's a Medical Cannabis Alliance Industry Association, which I believe ACE and certainly PharmaCann is a member of. We're working to get additional causes, debilitating medical conditions added. Other groups like Normal, I believe, are working on them. And so there is a concerted effort to obtain the data and evidence and information needed in order to get those sorts of conditions added in the future.
Go ahead, Brett.
Yeah, the law is designed to evolve. That's why this panel meets twice a year to receive petitions and hold hearings on those petitions. So someone suffering from depression has the right to file a petition, and they have the right to appear at this hearing where the Medical Cannabis Advisory Board will openly debate the prospective strengths and the prospective risks of recognizing depression as a condition.
And I would just add, at the last hearing, 11 of the 14 conditions that were presented were added. So it seems very, very possible to continue to add conditions. I think you just need scientific evidence to prove that there's a causal benefit.
Here's another random question. Somebody here is receiving federal student aid, and they are an NIU student, and they're concerned that if they got a card, would that jeopardize their student funding?
I'm not sure. I don't think that it would. In a similar circumstance, we have heard, you know, we work to pair up, develop relationships with different organizations. We've heard from them the same sort of concern. What would they lose their federal funding? You know, I think when you look at the current posture, that there certainly has not been a desire to go after, prosecute those involved with medical cannabis. And I'm not, it would seem all, equally as odd to go after an individual who had sought to use medical cannabis under a licensed state regimen like in Illinois.
Here's another question. This one is from someone who says they live in a rural community of less than 5,000 people and they don't anticipate being close to a dispensary. So how are they going to get their medicine? I don't know if there's mail order. You know, in some states they actually deliver to your home.
Unfortunately, the only way to obtain medicinal marijuana is going to the dispensary. However, there's a program from the Illinois Department of Health where you can identify a caregiver to go to the dispensary for you and obtain the medicinal marijuana for you. It also brings back to point the 2.5 ounces in a 14-day period. I think the state took that situation into consideration when putting that amount in place, because traveling back to different dispensaries, depending on where you live, might be difficult. So those are two things.
Here's one. It says, is there still a lawsuit in court about dispensaries in Illinois? What's the status of that? I vaguely remember reading something about this, but I'm not. Does anybody know what's going on with that?
Yeah, there's still a few pending lawsuits. I don't believe any of them are with dispensaries. I believe they're all with cultivation centers. But one of them, I believe there were four lawsuits total. One of them was dropped, and then I believe another one picked up after that one was dropped.
Okay.
I think there's just one active suit that's remained. I think that's maybe down in Shelby County.
And that's over a license or something? Some kind of?
Yeah, I think it's over a license being granted and in a declaration of nonprofit status. And whether or not they're entitled then to apply for the program.
Okay, here's, I like this one. It says, how and when can a person apply to assist in working in this industry? What's PharmaCann doing about that? PharmaCannabis.
We are hiring.
All right.
We are doing lots of hiring. So please check out our website, PharmaCann or PharmaCannabis.com. We have a lot of different positions that were open, and so please let us know.
We also have started hiring at the corporate facility in the Chicago suburbs. We're hiring our corporate level jobs, but then we've also begun at the facilities. One facility is near Quincy in a small town called Barry, and the other facility is near Peoria in a small town called Delavan. A very small number at first, but as production ramps up, so will our hiring.
So right here in DeKalb, Sycamore, this part of Illinois, where will our closest dispensary be at this point? Do we know?
I think, conveniently, maybe the closest dispensary may be North Aurora. I have to look at the map. But,
yeah, there's still a license up for grabs in DeKalb County. So DeKalb County was allotted one dispensary license in the original application period. Nobody applied for it. So at some point in the future, the state of Illinois will open up that application period for the DeKalb license and two other dispensaries in other parts of the state. But in theory, there will be at least one dispensary in DeKalb County.
And in talking to some of the individuals in the room, the two that seem to be is the North Aurora and also Schaumburg, I think, is one.
Did Sycamore?
Yeah, I thought I heard something about Sycamore, too.
The people that are looking to go for the DeKalb County license, I believe, are looking at Sycamore. They might also be looking at Genoa and Rochelle. But I think, at least in the DeKalb County itself, there will be, in theory, one dispensary. Whether or not it's in Sycamore, DeKalb, Genoa, we'll have to see what the state of Illinois grants that license to.
Go ahead, you have a question.
Actually, I have a question. About a week ago, I was reading the notes on the DeKalb County Board, and there was something mentioned that they had approved a dispensary location for Gateway Drive across from the hospital. So that is what the DeKalb County notes said, something that I read about a week ago.
Well, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to receive a permit from the state. It indicates that they're likely to apply for one, and they may or may not have other competitors applying for that same license. What it likely means is the local municipal body has approved that location as being in conformity with zoning laws, local zoning.
Yeah, the state has not opened up the dispensary licensing process for a second round. And so until they do, it's difficult to know who will apply. My guess is you'll see multiple applicants for dispensary licenses in DeKalb County.
Can I ask sort of a question on my own here? So how much revenue is this program going to generate? And the way I understand the law, all that money is designated to go right back into the program. There's no chance of lawmakers gutting that and using it for other purposes, is there? I asked naively. I've covered a lot of state capitals. I know how it works. I'm just asking a rhetorical question. Go ahead.
On the revenue side, there's fees. There's lots of fees. $200,000 license fee, yearly renewal, $100,000 license fee for a cultivation center, licensing fee out of the dispensary. Then there's taxes that are placed on the sale from the dispensary, cultivation to dispensary, and so and other structures in place. So I think Normal had some numbers on what they thought the total revenue of sales would be in the state of Illinois, as well as maybe what the expected tax revenue would be.
I'm not familiar. I know ArcView Investor Network said it would be about a $36 million industry in Illinois, given the restrictive nature of it. I think the biggest way that the state itself is going to make money is the licensing fees, specifically for each strain of cannabis that the cultivation centers are going to be producing. That seems to be where they're really looking to make money from this. And I have no faith in the maintaining of the funds in this program. The state of Illinois is a genius when it comes to sweeping funds for whatever purposes when it comes to the cash shortage down in Springfield. So while it may all supposed to be going back into the program, it's supposed to be cost neutral. This time of year, with the budgets, debates being where they are, funds can be swept all the time.
From applications, the state has already received close to $5 million. That's because there was it over 300 applicants total?
The 360 some applications for 81 total licenses.
So that 300 and something licenses times the license fees equals close to $5 million. On top of that, everyone who was awarded a license for the cultivation centers, it was $200,000 each. A sum also for dispensaries, that amount I can't recall. So that's all the licensing fees. On top of that, cultivation centers are taxed at 7% of everything they sell to the dispensaries. And let's not forget about the county governments, which will be receiving property taxes on the value of the new facilities.
Okay. And there's also a 1% tax at the retail level from the patient purchasing from the dispensary.
We're talking a lot of money here, it sounds like to me. So when I go to a dispensary, I've never been to a dispensary, so I have my card, I drive up. What am I going to experience? I mean, I'm sure it's not like Walmart, right? What is it going to look like? What's the mood going to be? Is there going to be high security? Is anybody allowed to go in, or do you have to have a card? I have no idea.
So I can only speak for PharmaCannabis experience at our dispensaries and what we have in place. First of all, the only individuals that can access the dispensary are those that have a card. So you have to have a card to even go through the front door. So you'll be greeted at the front door and asked to show the card, and only then are you allowed in. So caregivers would have to have cards as well, too. The patient would come in if it's a first time at the PharmaCannabis dispensary. We would greet you, give you a package of introduction to PharmaCannabis. It's an intake package. From there, we'd ask if you want some counseling initially on the program and so forth. Once that is established and your card is checked and it's shown through the Illinois Department of Health, so you fill out some basic forms, and then you're taken back to the dispensing area, which is a secured room. You're met with a dispensary technician. That dispensary technician sits down with you in the dispensing room, which again is a secured area, discusses your condition, your administration methods that might work, the different strains, what would be most appropriate, your familiarity with it. From there, you're giving some information on the administration and how to use it and so forth. Everything is logged into a system, again, that goes right into the state so that it's showing that you are a patient, you are able to get access, you're able to have a certain amount on that particular day depending on how often you've come in and purchased. Again, it's 2.5 ounces in a 14-day period, so that's all tracked through the system. It's showing what you're purchasing in terms of edibles or vapes or so forth. Once that's determined, the product is bought through another secure location into the dispensing room. It's packaged in a sealed container. There's nothing open. So once that is brought out of the secured location, it's put into an exit package, which is also sealed and labeled and tracked, again, through the state system in terms of what was purchased and what was bought. At that point, you're escorted out of the secured area into the waiting room area. If an individual needs some extra help to the car or so forth, we would have individuals available to help with that as well, too. The dispensing, our dispensaries are going to be minimalistic in their design. There's not going to be huge oak leaves or anything on our building. It's going to be appropriate, minimalistic, well-lit, easily accessible, and so that it's a process that's comfortable for the patient.
I think a couple points that are important to note is that by law, there's no patient use allowed on premises. And I think we have seen, I'm not so sure about all the groups that have been provided, but I think generally there's a couple of different models. But PharmaCann dispensaries very much follow. It's very similar to a doctor's office visit model as opposed to much more of a retail. There's certainly nothing akin or to, you know, the traditional head shop, certainly not at the PharmaCann locations. We'll have a limited number of ancillary products, traditionally maybe a couple of, you know, depending on the class of the product, a couple of different product categories and a couple of ranges in the class of the product provided. But it is really, as Chris Mina mentioned, it's this minimalistic thing. It's about getting patients in, getting them counseling, getting them through their purchase, and then having them safely exit the facility.
Well, as you know, there's been some news about this situation in Freeport, and I guess some neighbors around there are concerned about growing the crop. And what about zoning? I mean, and obviously there are rules with schools, but what goes into that with zoning and cultivation and dispensaries?
You know, on the application, you were required to, I think, demonstrate for cultivation that you're not within 2,500 square feet of schools, churches, those sorts of things. Our facilities, our cultivation facilities are incredibly remote. And so we certainly, and we've been through, worked with our towns and locations. I'm assuming every successful applicant has done that. When it comes to dispensing, the facilities, our facilities are incredibly discreet. They are in either industrial or commercial areas, and they certainly fit within the surrounding areas. And so the nature of the communities they're going into, but they're not residential, they're not near schools, playgrounds, that sort of thing.
Okay. Tell us more about what we can expect in the future. So if the pilot program is extended, is this just going to be a four-year leapfrog type situation where it's extended for 4 years? Or what can we, if we're looking into our crystal ball now, what would you anticipate we can look forward to? Any of you?
I think we'll see the pilot program extended for four more years. I definitely think that there's going to become a debate in the state of Illinois in the General Assembly about legalizing cannabis for all adults. I think the shape of that debate over a few years will really dictate what people can expect when it comes to the adult responsible use of cannabis in Illinois. As I mentioned earlier, I think the likelihood of new licenses for more businesses is going to be somewhat small because most of the people that spent a lot of money to get these licenses aren't going to want to see the competition. I think the ability for adults to be able to grow this plant on their own is also something that could be resisted either at the level of the medical cannabis cultivation centers level, the law enforcement level, or just the ability of the state to be able to collect taxes off of that private non-commercial production. Nevertheless, I've come up with a few ways that they could tax that type of non-commercial private production just so that we can hang that fiscal carrot out in front of the state of Illinois. But I think that somewhere down the road, you'll see this program inevitably extended. I do not foresee it going for 4 years or 2.5 years at this point and then not being renewed at all. I don't know if anybody else on the panel thinks that there's a honest likelihood that this program won't be renewed or extended at some point.
No. almost every state, as far as I know, has some legislation to license and regulate medical cannabis. What happens in Illinois will be largely a factor of what happens in other states as well. If we want to continue to be competitive, and Illinois should want to be competitive, then we'll continue to let this framework evolve.
I think there is a risk that the program may not be renewed. I think it's very important that we, I think those in the industry, as well as our communities and patients and caregivers, continue to impress upon their legislatures the need to advance this program, the need to remove restrictions on patients, ultimately to get patient counts up, because when you get patient counts up, then you've increased access to medicine. But I think from the state's perspective, and what the legislators will not be able to overcome, is that there is sufficient revenue coming from the program to justify and move against the political will that would fight against it. I think Liu Lang himself has said that it's very important for this program that patients sign up and become active. With low patient counts, then I think you start to lose the interest of the legislatures. And so I think it's important and imperative for everyone to go through the process that needs access to the medicine, to go through the process, to get their card, to become involved, and to continue to support it and work with their legislatures to do so.
So how can people get more involved? Sometimes we feel like we're all very busy people, and is it as easy just as firing off an email, or what can we do to make that happen?
Well, I think there's several. Certainly Normal here is a great organization, working on a little bit broader scope than medical cannabis, but certainly at the forefront of the issue. I think being involved with your local communities, I think speaking out, working to remove the stigma, making yourself comfortable with the benefits, the pros and cons of medical cannabis, pushing your legislatures, getting involved, getting your card, that's very important.
And I just want to touch on that point really quickly that John said. I think it's important to just have the conversation and bring it up because there's such a strong stigma with it. You know, our retirees are afraid to discuss that they might be going for a card because of the stigma. So the dialogue is one thing that everybody can do. Everybody can talk about the fact that, hey, this is something that may work for me. This is something that I'm looking into. I see how this may be appropriate. And just continue the dialogue at a very simple level. If everybody just did that, just had the conversation, and it wasn't a joking conversation, right? It's a serious subject. It's a serious issue. And so it's not something to make the jokes about, but talk about in a serious fashion of saying, I believe in this. I have somebody. Here's my story. Here's what I know. At a very fundamental level, that would be great.
And Stephen, I would add, you know, you told the story about your father. My mother, severe, debilitating rheumatoid arthritis, joints removed, replaced, all over her body. And so she was at a family wedding and said, I'm going to get my medical cannabis card. No history of use. She knows, obviously, her son's involved. She said, I'm going to get it. She says it to her brother, my uncle. I mean, I'm thinking about getting my card. And he joked. He said, oh, funny, you're going to want to get stoned. And my mom's, you know, well, I don't want to give her age away, but she's older than me. And so she tells that. And then she comes home. She says, you know, why is that funny? I'm in constant pain. I can't get a night's sleep. My doctor has said I can get any opioid. He'll prescribe anything I need for the pain. And so we started to have the conversation. And so now she goes forth and tells her friends, probably said, I'm getting it. I need the relief. And I think once she started doing that, she reports back to me, you know, my friend so-and-so, they're going to do the same thing. I think that's the groundswell. Organizations like Normal, other people have been leading the way, but I think it's time for the rest of our community to start speaking up, speaking as a caregivers on behalf of their friends, patients, family members, saying this is okay, there's no stigma, it should be extended, it must be extended.
Yes, I agree with all that. We have to hold our elected officials accountable. We have to let them know that we're paying attention to the way they vote and what they say or don't say about these issues. And if they're going to continue to refuse to allow Americans safe access to medicine, we have to let them know we're not going to reelect them. This is ridiculous.
And on that same note, I'm not sure how far the audience came to attend this, but State Representative Bob Pritchard's office is right on 23 across from the hospital. He voted for medical cannabis. He didn't always vote for medical cannabis, but the law that we are currently talking about, he did vote for. So give him a thank you. Stop by his office. It's real easy to complain about government and crooked politicians, but every now and then they do the right thing, and we need to thank them and give them a pat on the back. Bob Pritchard's a good guy. Thank him for this vote on medical cannabis.
By the way, I did invite Bob Pritchard to attend tonight, and he did write me back an email and said that he had a previous engagement, but he was here in spirit, so just so you know. Okay, does anybody have any more questions before we wrap it up tonight? Sir, in the back with a hat.
You say you have to have a relationship with the doctor. I mean, how many... We have a physician that's qualified and documented for your regular doctor. You go see this doctor, well, how many times do you make me come back and charge me $100 a pop or $150 a pop?
Yeah, the state was purposely... Yeah, so the question is, you know, what is a true bona fide relationship with the doctor? And then the state was purposely ambiguous or vague on that point. They didn't have a, you need to be seeing the doctor for 6 months, or you didn't need to see the doctor for three visits, because they knew that this program was an imperfect program. They know that doctors pick up and move, doctors die, so they wanted to be able to allow you to create that relationship with the doctor, and it's really not a defined, you know, three visits or 6 months. You need to see the doctor, and that doctor needs to certify that you have this qualifying condition, then you would benefit.
If you have documentation for the condition.
Yeah, and for what it's worth, there are a number of these clinics that are opening up where there is a doctor that's willing to write these recommendations. They are going to charge you money. They're not going to take insurance for it. Technically, the lawmakers did not want to see these type of facilities opening because they saw what was happening in California, where anybody could go to these doctors and pay them and they would get the card in California. Yet in Illinois, they tried to structure the law so that you wouldn't have these type of clinics opening. Nevertheless, some of them have opened. Some of the doctors have been punished by the state for doing that type of a business operation. And I would be reluctant to say to go to one of those clinics, but if it's a matter of life and death and you can't find a doctor, you need to go and pay one of those doctors so that they can write you the recommendation and you can get in this program.
But can they make you come back three or four times if you have a documented condition?
They can sit there and say that they want you to show up three times before they write that recommendation, and that's where it's really up to you. Are you willing to put up with that, both the time and the money?
Find a different doctor. Yeah,
well,
find a different doctor.
They do need to sort of build a medical history with the patient to protect themselves rather than just give a certification to everyone who comes in the door. So that's partly why they do that.
Anyone else?
Is money isn't the main part?
It sounds like it.
It is.
Your question, please.
My question was, for people who do go ahead and qualify and get the card, is there any provision in the law that allows for growing a small amount for your own needs?
There is not.
No, the home cultivation was taken out of the law. I mean, like I said, this was a 10-year legislative process. For the better part of 7 of those years, we did allow for patients or their caregivers to home cultivate. We got a bill through the Illinois Senate in 2009 that allowed patients and their caregivers to grow. But unfortunately, the political bargaining table, that was one of the first things to get taken away because the state felt that they would be almost impossible for them to regulate that. They saw how that was working in other states, specifically California and Colorado. They did not like that. And ultimately, it was never part of the final law that got passed.
You know, in California, I used to live in California, in Sacramento, And literally, in California, they have sign spinners out in half an hour. I'm surprised they don't have drive-thrus there, frankly, with the certified doctors that give out the cards. But that's a different state. Go ahead, in the blue T-shirt here, please. That's a good question.
There was in the original draft rules, which was just a draft, that you were going to have to surrender your firearm owner identification card. That was taken out of the finalized rules for the program. However, and I'm not a lawyer, but I can tell you that it is a huge legal mess when it comes to both being in possession of a firearm and being a medical cannabis patient, mostly because of the way that the Federal Department of Justice guidelines specifically say not to involve a weapon in any type of medical cannabis business or consumption, along with the way that the ATF specifically targets drug crimes as aggravated drug crimes with a firearm. It's still a legal gray area. They are working to resolve that down in Springfield, but it's not a real clear cut you can or can't. As of right now, you can be a patient and have a FOID card, but if you were going to be brought into federal court for violating the federal law, which still maintains cannabis as an illegal substance, in theory they could make those charges grander by making them an aggravated charge because of your possession of firearms.
Okay, we have time for just a few more questions. Gentleman here in the green.
Yes, I'd like to raise another paradoxical question with regard to the federal government. Correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is after some years of medical marijuana being available in many states, there haven't been any indications of significant negative side effects that have occurred. That being the case, why has the federal government, I believe the DEA is in charge of this decision, not rescheduled marijuana to a lower classification to enable more research? Because people talk about, it needs to be researched. Well, that's the point. If you lower the classification down to what it should be, then research could be done.
Yeah, The DEA, there's no motivation for them to reschedule cannabis. They're a bureaucracy. If they reschedule cannabis and are no longer prosecuting or investigating cannabis crimes, that's going to cut into their budget. They're going to have to lay people off that are focused solely on that. The FDA is kind of the same way. The FDA is in the pockets of the pharmaceutical companies. It's a revolving door of who's running the FDA from what pharmaceutical company they're leaving and then which one they're going back to. And I would say that on the federal level, there is a little bit of momentum, but nothing from the agencies or the bureaucracies to reschedule cannabis. If anything, it's from the congressional representatives of medical cannabis states that are starting to push mostly some of the banking issues and tax code issues a little bit when it comes to the rescheduling of cannabis, but there really isn't the public outcry. 80% of people support medical cannabis. That doesn't mean that 80% of the population is constantly talking to their U.S. senators or congressional reps about this issue. And I don't see the real motivation at the federal level to reschedule cannabis coming in the next 5 years.
Time for a couple more. Right here in the green, please.
I think there's a variety of different models that cultivators and dispensaries are utilizing. And PharmaCann is completely in-house with respect to security, for example. I think there's several other companies, cultivators, that have outsourced to third-party security companies.
What about banking? We've heard, this is a cash industry, and as we know, we've had issues with the federal government. Where do these dispensaries and the growers and people in the business, where are you putting your money? I know there's been talk about creating their own banks, but that's certainly a dilemma at this time.
Yeah, I think banking is something that everyone talks about quite a bit. I think with respect to the cultivation companies, I suspect that all of the cultivation licensees have a relationship with the bank. And it's something that I think people generally they're reluctant to talk about because the relationships are can be tenuous or fragile. On the dispensary side, they tend to be smaller companies. I'm not sure if they all have banking relationships, but there is, you know, there is an issue with respect to cash that, you know, traditionally the payments, when you go to a dispensary, they tend to be cash payments. There tends not to be credit card processing. Sometimes you can have like a prepaid debit card, those sorts of things, but generally it's cash or cash equivalents.
Well, I think Chase Bank is coming around on this issue from what I've been reading, but we'll see what happens. Right here in the black in the back, please.
Dan, can you please talk about some other bills that you're working on in Springfield and what you really need help on and calls to?
I'm not sure that this is the proper venue to talk about other political activities.
Uh-oh. Okay. Right here in the black, the gentleman standing up.
Mine's more just a thank you to the panel and to you at WNIJ or NIU for just hosting us this event. Just hope getting us information out to the general public who aren't aware of what's going on. So again, thank you.
Thank you for coming. Okay. Got time for one or two more here. And the gentleman in the orange with the cap, please.
How long is it going to take? What's the timeline on these new 11 conditions? Did the state say how long they were going to take on approving these?
They didn't really say how long they were going to take. Considering that the next round of petitions starts in July, I would think that they rule on them before the next round of petitions. But there's no real firm deadline that they have to do anything, unfortunately.
Okay. You, sir, in the brown?
I'm wondering, as a military veteran that's applying for an application or for a license, or not a license,
certification.
How can you go about doing that when you can't get a certification from your VA doctor?
Illinois actually got this one right. For military veterans, you don't need to have certification from anyone at the VA facility. You can directly send in your records demonstrating that you have a debilitating medical condition. Did I get that right?
Yeah. The doctor just has to say you have the condition.
And
It's your records.
Right. So your D214 form, you have to submit that. And then another form, I don't have it off the top of my head. Those two forms you submit with your application and you all the other steps you put in place as well, too. And then your reduced fee is $50 from the $100.
Kind of a follow-up question. Who is it that determines whether you qualify or not there at the department?
Who are these people?
Is it like a doctor? Is it somebody that's trained?
There are people that are they're employees of the Department of Public Health. Whether or not it's a doctor or a law enforcement specialist, most of these people are good, hardworking Illinoisans that have been working for the Department of Public Health that are now told this is your job is to go through these applications. I don't think any of them have any real strong opinions one way or the other about this medicine or this program. From my understanding, a lot of them, they're just following their marching orders of what the boss told them to start working on.
Okay, I think that pretty much wraps it up. And I want to, again, thank our panelists. They were great. I learned a lot tonight. I really did personally, and I hope you did too. The program is called Contacts. We appreciate you coming. Please tell your friends. We're going to do more of this in the future on other issues. But, again, it's very important that we support public radio so we can do things like this. So I want to thank each and every one of you for coming out. They're going to stick around for a little bit after if you want to talk to them personally. If you feel more comfortable doing that, then we encourage that. So everybody have a safe drive home. Good night. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.